up, I had a couple of housekeeping chores from yesterday. Mike asked a question about my comments on service versus worship, and I really only put him off because of time. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but let me give you a couple of passages to consider in that regard. One of them would be 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 6. This is in regards to the difference between service and worship. In 1 Kings 9, 6, the admonition is, "But if ye shall eat at all, turn from following me, ye or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods, and worship them." We've got a very similar phrase in 2 Corinthians 7 and 19, which to me clearly distinguishes that there's a difference between serving and worshiping. I think back under the Mosaical law, you could easily see this in that the descendants of Aaron were the priests who were involved in the worship ceremony at the tabernacle, but many of the other Levites were involved in tasks of service. To bring that up to our modern day, if I or you are participating in the worship service on Sunday, then that's a form of worship. But if I come over and mow the grass, it's a little hard for me to really call that an act of worship. That's an act of service. Now, if I choose to stop before each blade of grass and praise the Lord for it, then maybe that would be worship, but I'd never get done. So there are things that are in the category of service that I don't believe are in the category of worship. And I think this is an important distinction, because sometimes people say, my whole life is a worship to God. No, it's not, in the sense I'm using it. Your whole life should be full of worship, but there are things you do in your life that aren't worship. The second thing I wanted to address, Jay asked a question about, and I believe he phrased it, can we worship alone? Oh, if other men can keep us from worshiping. And I said no, and I stand by that. In talking to Jay a little bit more, he specifically cited cases where a person might be converted while they're in prison. Does the fact that they are incarcerated keep them from worshiping? No, not at all. Now, it does, in my opinion, keep them from worshiping in the full sense. They can't participate in the corporate worship, but they certainly can worship. And my judgment or opinion on that is, if they have no other alternative, it would seem to me like God would accept that, because God's not going to hold us accountable for things we can't do. But once in that case released, then that person ought to affiliate themselves so that they can also be involved in the corporate worship as well as the singular personal worship. Any comments or questions on those, Jeannie? Did I say Corinthians? 2 Chronicles 7:19. Thank you for asking, because I misspoke. 2 Chronicles. Tom?
What? Well,
where are we at here? Oh, I'm sorry, Clifford. I didn't see you. Sorry. Go ahead, Clifford.
While I was in the service, I became a member of the body of Christ, home on leave. And I went back with a brand new Bible. And this is hard for me to swallow yet to this day. I studied. I took time out, even though we were very hard-pressed for sleep, and was studying. And I wrote questions home to my mother and stepfather and all that. One day I went to get my Bible. Can you believe somebody stole that book?
Yeah, I can believe it.
Why? Why would somebody resort to theft, which is against God's will? That has bugged me ever since. I was out there in the boonies.
I feel your pain.
What?
I feel your pain.
Well, you see, I was nowhere near any civilization for another 2 years. There was no Bible.
That's a little bit like the story of the man that checked into the motel and started reading the Gideon Bible and became so enthralled that he took it with him. It's a little bit of a paradox, isn't it?
I never did see it again. I had a suspicion that maybe it took a long drink over the side. Yeah. That's pretty easy done in the Navy.
Well, let's just pray that it did whoever took it some good. Tom?
I believe our word worship means worth-ship.
Yes.
What we do to show the worth of God.
That's
how,
right.
And it usually does, it does apply to certain things that we do in contrast to our overall life. Our overall life must be dedicated to God and a living sacrifice. But there
worship for me has specific acts that we engage in. And we can do some of those privately, no question about that. But we can't do them all privately. But I think it's important to make that distinction. Marvin?
Can I worship without serving or serve without worshiping?
Marvin's question is, can he worship without serving or serve without worshiping? I think you definitely cannot serve without worshiping. And in the pure sense, I don't think you could do the other without it, because they're both essence of obedience. I would be hard-pressed to make the case for doing one without the other. We can do acts of service, but not serve in terms of our life's commitment to Him. Anybody else? Okay, with your permission, I'd like to move to the next topic that I had listed. Yesterday was easy plowing, in my opinion. I think it was deep plowing if we really absorb, but no one disagreed with that we need a good relationship with God. If you disagreed with that, you wouldn't be here. I know that. But I want to enter in now to our relationship to the world. And I might as well warn you right now, I'm not a very happy camper. I don't know if I'm angry or not, but I'm close to it. So I hope that I can share some of that feeling and passion with you, but do it in the way that is beneficial and exhortive. I'd like to begin by a little writing by a man by the name of Joseph Aldrich. This is a fictitious writing. It's a post-ascension setting. And it describes a very brief discussion that he set between Gabriel and Jesus, just as Jesus went back to heaven. Gabriel says, "Lord, you must have suffered terribly for men down there." Jesus said, "I did." Gabriel said, "And do they know all about how you loved them and what you did for them?" Jesus said, "Well, no, not all. Only a handful of people in Palestine." Gabriel was a little perplexed and said, "Then what have you done to let everyone know about your love for them?" Jesus said, "Well, I've asked Peter, James, and John, and a few other disciples to tell other people about me. Those who are told will in turn tell others. And my story will be spread to the farthest cities of the world. And ultimately, all of mankind will have heard about my life and what I've done." Gabriel frowned and said, "But what if Peter and James and John get tired? What if people who come after them forget? What if way down in the 20th century, people just don't tell others about you? Haven't you made another plan?" Jesus said, "I haven't made any other plans. I'm counting on them." Now, the apostles didn't let Jesus down, did they? But what about 20 centuries later? Have we let him down? In my estimation, if I were to grade the brotherhood as we know it, I would give us an F for spreading the gospel. An unequivocal F in general. It's not my desire this morning to make you comfortable, because I'm not. It's not going to be my purpose to tell you what a good job you've been doing in spreading the gospel, because I can't. It's not my desire to make you feel guiltless or unashamed, because I think en masse we all ought to feel guilty and ashamed of our evangelistic efforts. Now, when I get done, you'll have a chance to disagree or comment. That's fine. But I love the church. And that's why it pains me so deeply when I see it not being what it could be. I grow weary of elders that won't lead. And I grow tired of sheep that won't follow. And I'm ashamed of evangelists who don't evangelize. And we got a bunch of them, in my opinion. We talk about the duties of an evangelist. What about evangelizing? Many of our evangelists spend 5% or less of their time speaking to unbelievers. That's not all their fault. It's partly the demands we put on them. Wonderful teachers. But where's the evangelism? Evangelists in name, but not in function. We encourage young men to be evangelists. Sounds like a wonderful thing to do, doesn't it? But I'm troubled by why I'm afraid we do it. We have a sense that we need to be evangelizing, and so one of the ways to do that is to appoint more evangelists. Hogwash. We send out young men, relatively unprepared, mentally and emotionally, for the tasks that we're asking them to do. And then we wonder why the results aren't there. I'm fearful that many times we're looking for a warm, fuzzy feeling so that we can look ourselves in the mirror and say we're doing something on the evangelistic front, but we don't have to do it ourselves. A responsibility shift from you and I to others. Literally asking boys to do a man's job. And that's not fair to them, and it's not fair to the Lord. Should the man appointing an elder be less mature than the man he's appointing? Does it take less maturity to discern who would make a good elder than to be one? You might think I'm in a bad mood. Well, I don't know if I am or not. I just don't find much about this topic to put me in a good mood. If those who have lies and false doctrine can get up early in the morning and work late at night to share false teaching, why in the world can't we who have the truth do the same thing? I don't understand that. And I don't want to understand that. And if I ever start understanding that, you come and give me a swift kick. Our problem's not getting the word across the ocean. Our problem's getting it across the street. I'm not against those other efforts. Don't misunderstand me, but that's not our problem. We're a group of people that would willingly give to the Philippine effort, and much more willing to do that than walk across the street and talk to someone we've known for 20 years about the most important thing we could ever tell them. And I'm ashamed of that. Not of you, of that. We do what we want in general, and we don't want to share the gospel. That's the only conclusion I can reach. Now, Mike's going to talk to us tomorrow night about handling Christian anger, and I'm going to take a lot of notes because I know I need it. But I don't want to water down my disgust for our lack of effort on this front. I'm tired of congregations asking, why don't we grow, and then be totally unwilling to do the things necessary to grow. I'm tired of that. What are you doing now to spread the gospel that you weren't doing 2 years ago? How have you enhanced your evangelistic effort personally in the last 2 years? What would you like to accomplish evangelistically in your congregation in the next year that hasn't been accomplished yet? And what are you going to do to see that it happens? I'm really almost tired of talking about this because nothing seems to change in mass. And maybe that's the way it has to be. Change is on an individual by individual basis. I left our period together yesterday with the question, when was the last time you studied the Bible with a non-believer? When was it? Not too long ago, I was in the home of an elder, a good man. And while I was there for that period of time, a young family came to some of the services. And the congregation was just ecstatic because they didn't have very many visitors. I talked with this young family, and they had that look in their eye. And if you've ever seen it, you know what it is. It's like, tell us the truth, tell us the truth. We can't get enough. They're just like sponges. And I was talking to this elder, and I said, you know, I think that'd be a good opportunity for someone to study with that family. He'd been an elder for 40 years. He said, well, I wonder who we could get to do it. I said, well, what about you? He said, well, I guess I could. I never have. I don't understand that. The gospel is not complicated. Jim stood up here yesterday afternoon and told us about the power of the gospel. Now, do we believe that? I don't live in a town, and I've never been in a town any more difficult to preach the gospel than Ephesus was. What's the difference? A handful of people who wanted to do it. That's the only conclusion I can come to. I'll be receptive to comments. We have congregations in the Brotherhood that are growing, and we have congregations in the Brotherhood that aren't. And the single biggest definer of what makes a congregation grow and what doesn't is how many of the people in that congregation are spreading the word. It's a numbers game. It's exactly what it is. I weary of people that say no one's interested in the gospel. That's a lie. Maybe it's not 1 out of 2. Maybe it's 1 out of 20. Maybe it's 1 out of 50. So you've got to talk to more people to find them, but they're out there. And let's be honest enough with ourselves to admit the reason we aren't doing it is we don't want to. Now that was the conclusion of what I wanted to say, because I didn't want to run out of time. And maybe it's simply a transference, but I feel better. When you get this, look at the back. And I would like for you to write down in the left-hand column on that chart five people that you would like to share the gospel with that you never have. Write down five people. There's room for 10. I'm just asking for five. And this will be private. You don't have to share it with anybody. Write down and use initials if you don't want anyone to ever understand who it is. That's fine. Just so you know, five people that you would like to have the gospel shared with that you never, that haven't had it shared with. Thank you. While you're doing that, just let me make a comment. If you're having trouble thinking of five, that's a very telling thing. It's a very telling thing. One of the problems we have in sharing the gospel is we oftentimes become so socially myopic that we have very little significant contact outside of work with non-believers. When was the last time you had non-Christians, non-family, in your home for a social occasion? How many times do you have people in your home that need the gospel? We're a very myopic social organization. Many of us, it's church and family. Church and family. Church and family. That's fine. But where are the prospects to share the gospel with? We recently converted a family in our congregation about 3 years ago. He was Methodist, she was Catholic, but they had both studied themselves out of that. And after we had baptized them and they became part of our congregation, he made a comment that I've never forgotten, and he was right on the money. He said, I hope I never forget my friends in the world because they're the ones that need me most now. Many of us don't have any friends in the world. And I understand some of the reasoning why. We're sanctified. We're set apart. And we have to be careful. We're in the world, but not of the world. I understand that. But how in the world can you share the gospel with people you have no contact with? I love being with you, but you're not the ones that need me the most. You've got Christ. Why do you think Jesus went to the sinners and the publicans? Now this scores me, and I thought long and hard how to say what I've just said to you, but I don't know any other way to say it that doesn't score us. If this doesn't score us, we can't be scored. And we need to be. We need to be. I'm not going to ask for what your list is. I simply want you to keep that. And keep this in mind. What are you now going to do to see that it happens? Because God is depending on you. I probably don't know any of the names on your list. I can't be as effective as you can with the people on your list. As Mordecai said to Ruth in Esther, pardon me, in Esther chapter 4, who knows but what the Lord has placed you here for just this purpose? You know people that need salvation that nobody else can talk to as well as you can. What's keeping you from doing it? I'm going to pause. I've got 3 pages here that we can go through of scriptures, and that would be good. And I know that was heavy, but it was intended to be. Would anyone care to make a comment or ask a question before I go further? Lowell?
I don't have to share mine, but I guess the problems I see is the people that I work with, the people I associate with, would range from the, we might say, casting our pearls before swine to preaching in the choir, preaching to those in the choir, the sort, you know, they believe they're saved, but they're really believing a false doctrine. Those are the two problems I see. Could you address those?
Sure, I can. And one of the things I want to do is for us to list all of the reasons why we can't share the gospel. And those are two of them. Casting our pearls before swine. Scripture says, you know, don't do it. In the book of Acts, Paul and his contingent knocked the dust off their feet. But what did they do after they knocked the dust off their feet? It says they went rejoicing to the next town. To the next town. Casting our pearls before swine. I don't know when in that sense you define someone as a swine and exactly when you quit casting your pearls. I'd rather cast one too many times than not quite enough. But there comes a time when you simply aren't going to get anywhere. I understand that. I'm simply telling you I don't believe that's a signal to quit evangelizing. It's a signal to evangelize to someone else. I take no solace when I don't succeed. Jesus had a low percentage. If you take the parable of the talents, literally 1 out of 4 are going to be receptive. I don't think we need to take it that literally, but certainly the point is that the majority are not going to be receptive. The way is broad and the other way is narrow. But how many people there are? We have this mindset that nobody's interested, and I'm here to tell you they are. No, not 70%. Maybe not 20%. Maybe 5%. I don't know the percent, but they are. I labored until I was 42 under the assumption that nobody was interested. And I no longer believe that. The couple that I just told you about that we were able to study with and converted, they were so zealous that they went and preached the gospel to their parents and to all their brothers and sisters. And they barely knew A and B, let alone A, B, and C. But it was wonderful. And her name's Carrie, had a brother, and she said, I think I can influence some of my family, but Randy, or my brother, I'll never get to. He drinks. He's living with a woman. They've had a child out of wedlock, and I just don't think we'll ever get to them. A year ago, Randy and Sherry were married at 10 o'clock and baptized at 10:30. And I simply say, don't assume they can't be reached, or we don't believe in the power of the gospel. Now, one of the reasons we don't do it is we don't like to be rejected and we don't like to hear no. But they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting God. You're not a failure when they don't listen. The Bible never tells us to convert people. It tells us to spread the word. That's all we're asked to do. But we are masters at rationalizing why we're not going to do it, and I have to honestly say, I think it all comes back to the fact that we don't want to. Now that's harsh. And you don't have to accept it, but I've got to say it. Let's list some of the reasons why it's hard. On the front of this, I put down, why is it hard for us to do? Let's just list a few of those reasons. Lowell, give me your two again. Or give, put it in some word.
Preaching to those that already have a different faith. They don't want to listen to what we believe.
Okay.
And the other one was just...
those that aren't interested?
I guess.
Well, I should have. After I asked you, I should have let you tell me.
Well, I hate to say swine because I've seen people that I considered swine that just had no time for me or anybody else that had anything to do with religion. And then I've seen those people swallow a false doctrine and just be so fervent in it. So it's that's sad, you know.
Well, let me comment on those a little bit. My experience has been it's oftentimes easier to evangelize to someone that has no particular faith than someone who's already entrenched. I don't say ignore those that have a faith, but it's much easier. A fertile field has been my experience. Now, I don't think we should go out and say, do you believe anything? And if they say yes, then walk away. But just expect that someone who doesn't have entrenched values. I always tell people when you're marrying, it's always better to marry in the church, but if you don't marry in the church, marry someone who's not firmly grounded in a false doctrine. That's next best, because you'll have a better opportunity to convert them over. Those that aren't interested, there are going to simply be people that aren't. Don't get discouraged. You got five names on that list. If some of them fall into these categories, put a line through them and add another one. Just keep a list. And pray about this list. You don't have to do this by yourself. God's in it with us. He wants us to pray about these people. What else hinders us? Jeannie? Fear of, and I'll just put ruin our relationship. I'll just abbreviate that. Absolutely. Now, I'd like to be real kind on these, but I want to be more honest. I agree with Jeannie, and I've had people in that situation, but you know what that tells me about myself? It means I value my relationship with that person more than I value their soul. And we ought to be ashamed of ourselves for that. How in the world can we tell ourselves we love people if we value something more than their soul? We don't love them like God loves them. We don't have agape love if that's the case. This is real hard when it comes to family. Family is the hardest to preach to, in my opinion. Jay.
Part of the reason, as much as we should edify one another, we have a lack of priority regarding teaching the world compared to the other things in our lives.
Okay. I'm going to put that we don't want to. And I want you to understand, I believe in our hearts we want the church to grow. I believe in our hearts we want people to be saved. That's not what I'm saying. We just don't want it bad enough. Because if you want it bad enough, you do something about it. Marvin.
In the insurance industry, I know they say that if you have enough prospects, you will, by statistics, have enough sales. And I've proven that true in my own life, but I can't seem to get it together in my spiritual life that I have to make 100 contacts to make one sale, so to speak. I think it's because we judge that, like Lowell said, that they're swine before we know they're swine. How do you know he's a swine until you've had contact? You don't know that. Like, who would waste their time on Zacchaeus?
Yeah.
Except Jesus.
Who wants a little shrimpy crook? That's not the kind of people you build a congregation around, is it? No. John.
I've got two because two weigh heavy on my mind, and I see them in my own life. Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 17, God was telling Ezekiel how he'd set him as a watchman. And he said, I'd give you warning to give them. And if you don't give it to them, they're going to die in their iniquity, but their blood I'm going to require at your hand.
There you go.
Paul talked about knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men. I don't think we fear God. We don't fear the consequences of our foolish actions. And it'd be better if we learned to love the souls, but that will come with fear. It's the beginning of knowledge. It's the beginning of wisdom. Obedience out of fear. And one other thing, it's Paul said in 1 Timothy, to this end we both labor and suffer because we trust in the living God. And I don't think our faith is where it ought to be either. If we had faith in the promises of God, this labor would flourish. If we believe that He's done things for us and that He'll do that for them as well.
Sunday night I had talked to you about angels, and one of the passages I used was how the angels rejoice in heaven when a sinner repents. You know why I think they do that? Because they know how wonderful heaven is. And they know what everyone that doesn't repent is missing. And if we had a better belief and focus on how wonderful heaven is, wouldn't we want to take as many people with us? Dave.
I guess I got a question for you. As a manager, we started a Bible study at work. And one of the things I found immediately was that I was not a part of the group in the sense that, well, I was there, but they were talking about things that I probably shouldn't hear as a manager. Mm-hmm. And I found myself very uncomfortable in that conversation as the group got to sharing more and you know, talking more. There were just things that I felt uncomfortable hearing, and I finally excused myself from that. But it put me in kind of an awkward position.
Was this a religious discussion? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did it evolve into a gripe session?
No, it was mostly just talking about what people were doing with their time and that sort of thing. And there were things that as a manager, I didn't want them doing that sort of thing with their time.
Yeah.
As a Christian, I did. So, it got confusing.
Yeah, I don't criticize you. You were in the situation and had to make a judgment, and I don't criticize that judgment. But, and not speaking to you, but speaking to us, if that's not the right time, find another one.
Yeah.
Or another forum. You know, I was in sales and marketing for 15 years. Don't regret it a bit. What little skill I might have to do the works, Lord, were probably honed in that. I labored under the assumption that there were no Christian salesmen because it was inconsistent. When I finally got up enough nerve to just lay a few probes out, when you travel with salesmen, you spend a lot of time in a car. It's not unlike to spend 2 and 3 hours in a car. You know what I found? We had a sales force then of about 200. 30-40% of them believed in God and had some faith, and I had wonderful discussions with them. But you have to use some discretion. As a manager, you can't come in and say, well, you get 5% this year because you were baptized. I mean, you know, you've got to use discretion and keep those roles different. Dave?
Part two of that, I guess, goes to how I feel about telethons and the entertainers who get such great praise for being a part of a telethon or a fundraiser or something like that. And I guess I'm a little bit envious of their position because they're just doing their trade, what they know how to do, and yet they get all these people really glad of what they're doing. What I would like to find is an outlet for the rest of us to do our trade. You know, can I design something for somebody? You know, can I manage something for somebody? Is there a way that I can get involved in their life that way?
Mm-hmm.
That maybe we would do the same kind of good? So I guess my question there is maybe we need to get more creative in how we approach the evangelistic work. You know, my son is just avid on the computer, and so I keep encouraging him to try and look at how can you use that computer to work with people, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if I'll get to it today, and I'd only intended to spend one day on this, but I may hold it over for a little bit tomorrow. At the bottom of the handout, under key steps, and this isn't a rigid program, it's just a place to start. I want to make a few comments, and I'm not going to do it quite yet. Rob's got a comment back there. Of things, and Mike, of things that may help you get started. Rob, we're still on why we can't do it.
I think maybe we're afraid it might change our life. We might have more responsibility. We might be inconvenienced, take away from our free time.
That's kind of the old, I sure hate to ask to pick them up to church one time. They might want me to do it every week syndrome.
Yeah.
Inconvenience. I don't promise I spelled it right. Mike?
I have two. One, I guess we could call fear of somehow affecting our work. I'm a public school teacher, and I recall when I was working on getting my credential, one of the professors made it her practice and encouraged us to do the same, to not share one's particular religious convictions, one's particular political persuasions, those kinds of things that are very personal, with the students, for fear that we would negatively sway some of the students. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And the way this teacher handled it is she said, if a student, for instance, asked, what party do you belong to, her response would be, see me after you graduate, and we can talk about this as freely as you would like. But while you're still my student, I'm not going to do that. Well, I thought that was kind of a nice approach. So the very first semester, while I was doing my student teaching, I had a group of students after school, and somehow the discussion got on to religious issues, and they knew where I stood. And one of them asked me about religion. I said, well, see me after you graduate. And her response was, well, I need it now.
Sure. I'm glad. That's a good response, and she's absolutely right. I'm not sure you asked a question, but it was a great comment. Let me comment on your comment. There are circumstances when it's going to be inappropriate to broach this subject. Legally, you can get into some difficulties in the workplace, in the school. I understand that. So don't do it then. But I still come back to, but do it. I wouldn't want Mike to get in trouble, and there are places where you can lose your job if the teacher unduly. And that's probably not a bad situation, because we think, oh, it would be great to teach our Christianity, but we'd be upset if they were teaching Hinduism there. And we've got to be consistent. But there are times and ways. Maybe in that case, Mike can't do it because of his interrelation, but someone else could do it, or in a different setting. I just want us to get this list up here and then understand that this is not a mountain that keeps us from getting the job done. It's just things we got to consider. Mike,
I have a second one, and I'll be short on this one.
Right, that's all right. Your time.
Sometimes after we have converted or brought someone to Christ and they've been baptized and perhaps attended church for a while, then they fall away, and that can be discouraging.
Absolutely.
To work further.
Absolutely. What do you think Jesus felt like when Judas kissed him? Must have ripped his insides out. If I can be blunt. Sure. Hurts. When I've had the privilege of being involved with studying someone and them coming to the gospel, you can't believe the paternalistic feeling you have about that person. It's almost as if they're flesh and blood. It is. And when it doesn't work, it hurts. But that's not a reason not to do it, Charles.
I think a lot of times we have got the idea that, and we've got the long face principle that we're headed for heaven, but this is torture, what we're doing right now. There's people and I run into them all the time. There's people in the world that are going through torture that would think what we're going through and being a Christian would be wonderful.
Yeah. I mentioned Randy and Sherry. That was the couple. What really finally jarred him is he had a car accident, not a serious one, but one. And he just had a terrible day at work. He's a plumber. And he came home that night and looked at Sherry and said, "There's got to be more to life than this." And that was the fulcrum. From that point on, he well-read. Nostradamus. The man read the Bible through three times, cover to cover, before he was baptized. That one little thing changed. Power of the gospel. Jay.
Just two short things. One is that, do we have the same earnest desire? And that's not even the right phrase here. Paul was willing that his soul would be alienated from God if his fellow Jews would be converted to Christ. Now, he said that knowing it could not happen, but that showed his earnest, intense desire. And the other thing is a fear, I think. The average Christian seems to have a fear that they don't know enough to tell someone how to become a Christian. I think this is a deception from Satan. All Christians can tell others what God has done for them and how he's done it. Now, they cannot quote all the verses they need, and perhaps they need to study them. Perhaps they need help. But sometimes there's a deception to saying, I can't do this.
I don't want any of us to dummy down, but I believe some of the most effective evangelists, in terms of doing evangelism, not in terms of holding the office, some of the most effective evangelists are those who aren't quite as well-learned as some others, because they have less of a tendency to talk over the heads and try to impress people with all their knowledge. Most of the Bible studies I have with non-believers, when I say, let's go to the book of Acts, they go to the table of contents. It's not uncommon for a guy, I had one guy ask me if we could study the book of Job. Well, why should he know that's pronounced Job? Spelled Job. We just don't, you know,